committee will convene. We'll start first today with House Bill 3202. I notice we're on a work session, so I will give everyone a chance that wants to talk on both bills that are up. And we can just keep it fairly brief, I'd appreciate it. But let's start with House Bill 3202 and the proponents, John Ledger and Paul, want to come forward and see what this does. I know we had a tap-in hearing, but not an official work session or hearing even on it, so we need to cover that for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries. This bill deals with pollution control tax credits. Pollution control tax credit is a credit that a company can take against its taxes, income taxes, for some eligible projects. The method of calculating is very complicated and Byzantine, but generally the way it works is the DEQ looks at the facility cost, determines what part of the facility cost is eligible, that is, it reduces, it has to do with pollution control, and then multiplies that by 50%. So it's really a 50% of eligible cost. The size of these credits, which have been in place since about 1968, range from just a couple hundred dollars to millions of dollars. It's a huge range. There is a wide range of how many are given each year. It might be just a couple of dozen, might be several hundred. It varies a lot year to year. It ranges by type of company that receives the credits. However, the thing they all have in common is they all make something. So when you make something, you always have some type of a waste stream. So these credits are used by companies that produce material things and generally pay pretty good job wages, although some of them are small. But they're not service companies. About 90% of the tax credit awards go to companies outside of the city of Portland. So it's very important to the rural communities. The tax program has been extended year by year, actually 6 years by 6 years, and it is due to sunset at the end of 2001. And the reason it's important to renew it now is that facilities, when they're looking to locate in the state or expand in the state, or whether they're deciding which plant to close, the one here or Montana or Louisiana, they look at that with a fairly long lead time. Because if they're going to build something, it means they have to buy the land, they have to get the architect in, design it, they have to put it in place, buy the capital goods. And so it takes maybe 4 or 5 years to get all that put in place. So if we have a sunset, if the thing sunsets in 2001, that injects some uncertainty in the process because the company won't know if this program is going to be available or not to it in this planning phase, and this is an important piece. The pollution control tax credits do a couple of important things. One is they keep the facility in the state. That is, if a plant is perhaps being considered for closure, that's the internal competition, this can make the difference. It allows expansion, and it attracts good companies that pay good jobs to this area. And people that don't think that's important should look what the president is doing today and over the last couple of days. He's going around to areas of the country that do not attract manufacturing jobs and trying to drum up work for them, drum up manufacturing in those areas. It's important to pollution control. I'll give you just a couple of quick examples. In the Portland area, the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program allowed companies to put in state-of-the-art facilities to control pollution, so much so that the companies reduced their emissions way below what was required, so they actually got credits for additional reductions, and they were able to donate those credits to the DEQ. So you get a lot of good environmental things off of it. It allows the environmental manager to go to corporate and make a sale to say why he thinks this type of facility or this type of pollution control equipment would be a lot better. And it also allows enhanced technology because you do get a reduction in your pollution control costs. You can afford to use more enhanced technology or maybe push the technology a little further than you would. I don't think we will make pollution less by making it more expensive to reduce pollution. We reduce pollution by making it cheaper to reduce pollution. Lastly, one of the things is that the DEQ is largely supported by fees on corporations already. This offsets it a little bit. companies pay for their permits, Title V permits, air permits, water permits, community right to know program, you name it. So we believe that this program helps the rural areas especially. It's especially important now that we're working to save the salmon and upgrade our streams. And one last thing I will mention is that you will hear sometimes that this is being used by the big guys. You know, this is corporate welfare for the big guys. And I will just very quickly read the first two pages of the DEQ document that lists who gets these things. This is the A's. And but I'll just read it, and so you can see who takes advantage of this program, and you can judge how big they are, where they are. 4B Farms, Inc. in Brooks, Allen Bodish, Inc. in Lake Oswego, Albany Lebanon Sanitation in Albany, Anodizing, Inc. in Portland, Argay Disposal Service, Milwaukee, Mark B. Arnett in Redmond, Astoria Texaco in Astoria. These are the types of facilities that use this program. It's widespread and it helps our rural areas. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I will be very brief. Paul Costco, representing American Forest and Paper Association. And one of the other things that John mentioned, and I think you may hear about, is there has been criticism of this program that it, in fact, rewards people for doing what's already required. And I'd like to address that issue because I think it's a misplaced criticism. First of all, based on the tax expenditure report with data produced by DDQ, 35% of projects awarded under this program since 1980 have been for projects that go above and beyond all requirements. But in fact, it's a much higher percentage than that, and I'll give you an example from the paper industry. Many of the big credits that have been awarded in the last few years have been to paper industry plants, and they've been classified as air and water improvement projects in DEQ's data. And in fact, they have been to upgrade those to sometimes new requirements that have been posed by the federal government. But in fact, what those projects have allowed us to do is to use recycled fiber, where we've lost chips because of changes in forest practices acts and forest practices in this state. Recycling projects are not required. That's the only way we've been able to upgrade those plants is by using these credits. So even though in the data these are considered required meeting requirement projects, in fact, they go well beyond what's required under federal law, and they allow us to have one of the most vibrant recycling markets of paper in the West Coast. So this program is really vital for recycling, and it's been one of the major reasons that the recycling markets in this state, particularly in the paper industry as well as some other industries, have stayed as strong as they have. There is one other clarification in the bill to clarify legislative intent on the recycling issue, and that's in Section 2, where the information about recycling, the definition of recycling, is clarified using language that DEQ developed for its own legislative proposal. So that's, I think, an important additional element about this bill of what benefits it's been for recycling. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Gentlemen, would the credit be given only for new installations or new eligible products or for existing ones?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, many of the credits are given in existing plants, but they're always for new things that are done in those plants. I hope that answers your question. The credit does have, under its current operation, you have to complete the project before you apply. So in any year when you make your application, it's for a project you just completed, but with that one exception, it is a new installation.
Thank you. I have a question about the timing. You mentioned, Mr. Ledger, that the sunset has been extended in six-year blocks previously.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, it was last time. Previous to that, I'm not sure. It's been in different increments.
Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hey, others? Hillary, you wanted to give testimony? Come on forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Hillary Abraham at the Oregon Environmental Council. I'll be brief. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. The Oregon Environmental Council has some concerns about this bill. We believe that the pollution control tax credit may have made sense 30 years ago, but it no longer does today. We feel that instead it forces Oregon taxpayers to subsidize large polluters to simply comply with federal laws. In addition, by subsidizing large investments in pollution control equipment, we encourage industry to buy control equipment instead of making process changes or taking other steps to prevent pollution in the first place. Tax credits should be provided where we want to encourage exemplary behavior that goes above and beyond legal minimums. Tax credits and exemptions should be as well focused and well justified as an outright expenditure of tax funds. We believe this bill goes in the opposite direction of the recommendations of the Governor's Tax Task Force, of which OEC was a member, which recommended narrowing the availability of the pollution control tax credit. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Mr. Chair.
Could you tell us what the cost of the tax credit is currently?
The cost of the tax credit? I don't have those figures. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley. I don't have those figures with me. I did pick up a copy of Director Langdon Marsh's testimony, and in here, of April 14th, I think it is, and here he states that in the calendar year 1998, the Environmental Quality Commission certified pollution control tax credits worth over $67 million in expenditure liability for the state of Oregon. How that's broken up and what that actually represents, I don't have those figures.
Just to clarify, I think, under its current structure, there is no particular cap on the amount of the tax credit. It just depends on how many people apply for it.
Mr. Chair, mostly that's my understanding.
Other questions from the committee? Hillary, I think that any business trying to make improvements, they have to stay competitive. And so I don't understand your third paragraph here. You're talking about subsidizing large investments. And when you say we encourage industry by control for instead of making process changes, taking other steps, I think they, being involved in it myself, we look at process, we look at anything and everything that can provide certainly an improvement for us. We have to. That's part of doing business. So I think what we're talking about is something that is still involved, is a public purpose. And I think this program is very appropriate to Oregon and how we feel about our air and our water. So I really believe that I respect your approach, but it isn't quite on target here in really understanding business and industry.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And what I would just simply say in response is that I think environmental issues are becoming much more complex as we learn more about the relationship between all of our activities. Regular human beings as well as industry, the effects that we have on the environment, we're learning more and more. And I do sympathize with business in that there are going to be more expenses as a result of some of that information. And I do think that we should try in some ways to help business along so that we can comply with those regulations and so we can reduce pollution. On the other hand, I believe that if there are legal requirements that individuals or businesses are required to meet as a result of those standards, those should eventually be a part of a business's operating budget. And if there's a way that we can try and reach those goals and not economically burden business, I'd like to figure out a way. But I also don't think that taxpayers should be helping that along too much. So recognize it's a complex issue, as I think we all do.
Thank you, Helen. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Anyone else want to give testimony? House Bill 202. Come forward. Okay. Representative Cruz?
Just a comment. It was both in Hillary's testimony and then what we've got from Mr. Marsher that I guess it confuses me. We're talking about a tax burden that we're creating on the people of Oregon. And Langdon Marsh talks about a liability to the state here. And we're doing that by allowing people to keep their own money. It's not like we are, it's not like the taxpayers are paying some of their money to industry to do these things. We are allowing industry to keep some of their own money for doing things that benefit society. And, you know, it's just, we tend to get so wrong-headed on this. You know, it's the whole attitude that this is the government's money, and it never was the government's money.
Right. Industry's investment.
Yeah.
And they're mandated heavily. And this government compliance has to continue to the state.
And, you know, as yet to see the goods and services that the government puts out.
I know that we had some amendments, but as I understand, amendments are not aren't needed, and so we'll entertain the motion. That's Ms. Cruz.
I move House Bill 3202 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
That's Ms. Cruz. Move House Bill 3202 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Further discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about the fact that this bill essentially eliminates the serious discussion that sunsets are intended to provide. I'm sympathetic to the notion that, that if the bill was to sunset, we would need to have a phase-out period so that adequate planning can be made, and that's an important argument. I wish we had had that before us earlier in this session so we could have had a focus on the topic. And so primarily due to a concern with the process of doing this last minute and the bypassing of the intent of a sunset, I will vote no on this bill.
Sure. Thank you.
Just for the record, I spoke extensively about this last time we had. I've actually done some writing about this subject. My only frustration is that we didn't move this thing sooner. If we wanted to have a full debate, as Representative Merkley said, which I concur with. By moving this, I know we're kind of in hindsight now, but moving this earlier, I think would have allowed that. I'm in full support of it, given the fact of protection. And I will not comment any further on the tax issue, or as we did last time, but I will be supporting this today.
I find it interesting that we have concerns over extension of a sunset on a credit, but nobody ever seems to show the same kind of concern over extension of a sunset on a tax.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Atkinson.
Aye.
Representative Corey.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
No.
Representative Morgan.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Chair Welch.
Aye. Having received the appropriate number of votes, this House Bill 3202 passes. And who would like to carry it? Anyone? President Cruz will be our carrier. We close the work session on House Bill 3202. We open a work session on Senate Bill 1040. We have some amendments in the work group. I would like to have those who would like to come up and comment on the work group development here to come forward. And
good
the record, Pam Curtis from the Governor's Office, Policy Analyst in the Governor's Office of Healthcare, Human Services, and Labor. I want to start on behalf of the Works Group by thanking Chair Welsh and the Work Group co-chairs, Representatives Cruz and Kafouri, for allowing the Work Group the opportunity to bring before you some proposed language this morning. The Work Group included a very broad-based representation from stakeholder interests on this issue as the chair and the co-chairs of the work group called us together, and I was nominated to do the writing and bring this language before you this morning. As you all know, this is a very complex issue and one that I think cannot be fully addressed in the short period of time that we have left in this session, but I'd like to spend just a moment going through this language with you. Wrote it as if it were its own bill, just for ease, and I'll go through section by section and then answer any questions you might have. The first section, section one, is a series of legislative findings, and based on our understanding of some issues that the committee was concerned about, we included legislative findings that talk about the importance of safe communities, but also that affirm Oregon's longstanding policy for community-based services and community-based treatment. Section 2 are the definition sections, and again, based on our understanding about where the primary concerns lie, we define facilities essentially to be facilities for any person released from any youth or adult penal or correctional facility. Section 3 essentially states that before any of the agencies you see listed there, the Department of Corrections, the Youth Authority, Services to Children and Families, any city, county, or other public agency funds a facility as defined, they will do one of two things. Either first ensure that a process is already in place for gathering citizen input about the siting of that facility. That would allow the flexibility for local communities and local jurisdictions to put that process in place on their own. We're quite aware that in some communities a process is either already developed or underway, and that was something very important to the local government stakeholders at the table in this worker process. Or two, if a formal process is not in place, then that agency has to cause a process to be developed for gathering citizen input. And citizen input must be gathered regarding the kinds of issues you see starting on page 1, line 27, and let me just briefly outline those for you. The proposed location, population, and use of the facility, the qualification and the numbers of staff, the level of supervision of residents, which I know is something of great concern to some members of this committee, and other relevant information with the understanding that it was relevant information that the agency is legally able to release. And let me make a brief comment about that. There is some information that by state or federal law are not able to be released. And I know one of the points of concerns of the committee in a very specific way was sex offenders. And I would remind the committee that we have a sex offender notification law in Oregon, and that would not apply to them, or that would be taken into consideration. The input would be in writing, and any reason to reject any of that input would also be put in writing so that we have a record of that. Section 4 then states that after a facility has been cited and is in place, there must be put in place a mechanism for communication in an ongoing manner with the citizens of the affected area. That communication has to include a method for addressing citizen complaints, a method to integrate the program with the community. I know there was some discussion also about the need to integrate with community norms and values, programmatic changes that might occur at the facility, and also a process to mediate any problems or complaints that might arise. Section 5 sets up a work group in the 9901 interim, and starting on line 24 of page 1, names the members of that work group. I will say that in drafting this, I made an error, and I want to at least put that on the record. The work group asked that the membership brought to you also include consumers and employees of facilities, and I neglected to put that in the draft, and that was my fault. Then on the bottom of page 3, starting at line 26, it talks about how the work group will operate. Co-chairs would be appointed by the speaker and the president. And the work group would gather information about how this is being implemented, about the effectiveness of this, and particularly effectiveness in mediating or mitigating any disputes that arise as a result of siting or operation of these facilities, and to recommend changes that might be needed. Then the work group would report no later than December of 2000 to the Legislative Interim Committee on Human Resources. Last but not least, Section 6 talks about ensuring that what we do to implement the SAC would be consistent with local ordinances that may be put in place, so that would include zoning or any of those citizen input process, and also state applicable state and federal laws.
Good. That's inclusive. Thank you. Back to Section 2, the definition when you talk about facility, what occurred to me after our conversation was that a lot of times we will have folks who will go through A and B treatment in lieu of adjudication. And with your definition there, basically you're just talking about those who are released to a facility and not those who are assigned to a facility. And there would be a concern that maybe that's a population that should be addressed in this also, because having done some work with some of those facilities, there's some pretty ornery critters end up there too. So I guess a concern there is that maybe we have narrowed in the definition the universe maybe too tightly here and not dealing with some of the front end people too.
Chair Welsh, Representative Cruz. The work group actually discussed that issue, and I would just put a couple of other thoughts on the table for your consideration. One is that with the Measure 11 and the mandatory sentencing laws that we now have in this state, the work group felt like many of the issues of concern that you raised would be mitigated in that fewer people are diverted, if you will, out of the criminal justice system in the state than used to be the case. And second of all, again, depending on what you're talking about, some of those clients of those alcohol and drug treatment facilities, as you're well aware, are protected under disability laws. So those are two issues that the committee would also need to consider.
I agree that one of the unintended impacts of Measure 11 is that we now have DAs doing work with judges in a lot of cases, and so what we're going to have is DAs deciding on level of sentencing, and we're going to have people end up going to treatment as an alternative to having to go to trial for a Measure 11 crime when they say maybe it's inappropriate for that to happen. So I think there is a disconnect, and I'm not quite sure that this narrow definition actually gets to it.
Chair Welsh, Representative Cruz, it's one of those, as I started the testimony, I think this is a very complex issue, and we can probably, you know, fill two flip chart pages full of paper with potential folks here. It may indeed be something that you want to look at in your interim process.
Other questions? Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, we've got, I know others, I'm going to give a chance to anyone else who wants to give testimony here. I think we have another amendment here in concerns, and if the opponents for that come forward. Tom Holt. And we're looking at committee members. I think they have dash 810 here that we're provided.
Welcome, Tom. Chair Welsh and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm here today in a different capacity from what most of you are normally accustomed to seeing me. I'm here for the Oak Hills Homeowners Association, which is an approximately 630 home community located in eastern Washington County. We have a number of group homes of various kinds in our neighborhood, and we have no issue with that per se. We've had that for many years. The function of the Homeowners Association, for those of you not familiar with how these types of communities work, is twofold. One, the enforcement of architectural covenants and conditions relating to everything from paint colors to types of construction that can be done in terms of renovations and things of that nature. And the other part of our mission is simply the maintenance of park and recreation facilities. One of the oldest homeowners associations in the state, we've been in existence for about 35 years. Unfortunately, recently we've had some challenges with facility operators trying to find loopholes in our covenants and conditions, and we're not the only community facing this problem. These are essentially contracts that overlay the whole community, and they work by voluntary compliance. And if an operator is bound and determined to bring vast legal resources, particularly those of the state, into play, it becomes very difficult for us to enforce those covenants in the same way that we would with an individual homeowner. So we bring forth the 810 amendment. The LC has raised a concern about adding the chronically mentally ill to the list of those that would be subject to the bill's provisions, and we would be content to delete that portion of the amendment. However, the new Section 6 that we suggest would, we feel, provide some very clear guidance to particularly the Department of Justice that they shall not find loopholes in our covenants, conditions, and restrictions when none exist. This problem was brought to our attention most recently with a home where construction was done in plain violation of our covenants. There was no effort made to comply with our processes of making application for the construction, and we're in the process of resolving that issue. But in the course of that, there was assistance sought by the operator from the Department of Justice, which instead of reading our covenants the way we have all understood them to read for 35 years, decided that dwelling didn't mean dwelling. And thus we had a problem. And therefore, we simply suggest that we include in statute clear guidance that covenants and conditions, where they exist, and as these, that they shall not be interpreted broadly, that they'll be interpreted the way they're intended to read, the way policies of the community associations are filed with the county, as long as there's no discriminatory intent. And that's certainly not our intent. We think this would provide some added protection for community associations, which provide a number of services where they exist, and respectfully request that they be adopted as part of this bill.
Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Holt, you heard Ms. Curtis's presentation of the work group changes. And they include that each city or local jurisdiction should ensure that a formal process is in place. It seems to me that that's the appropriate place for concerned citizens to raise these issues, that we are not going to allow, as a body, these to be cited in a community or local jurisdiction has in place a formal process, or and then it spells out these certain things. I wonder if through that process is not the best way to address the concerns.
Chair Welch, Representative Taylor, I appreciate your view on that. I will point out that our community association, like all community associations, has a multi-layered process by which owners of properties in our community are expected to follow. Beginning with an application for any changes they might make to a property. There's avenues for appeal through the board of directors of the association. Then from there, it can go to a court for adjudication. There's a large body of law about community association governance, and our fear is simply that we have seen evidence of agencies that have way more resources than any of our communities would have, bringing to bear to try and essentially knock down key elements of our covenants. And while we appreciate the efforts to have, you know, an open process in terms of the location, our issue here is more once they are located, how are those properties maintained?
One more question, if I might, Mr. Mr. Chair. Thank you. Could you give an example of the kind of covenant or restriction that has been violated that you're aware of?
Chair Welsh, Representative Taylor, yes, I can. A recent example was a group home where it was purchased on behalf of the state, and the garage was converted into dwelling space. That was a plain violation of our covenants. There was no effort made to apply for the appropriate approvals, which could have saved the whole episode from taking place, because we simply would have said, no, you can't do that. In the event the violation was discovered well into construction and the association issued a stop work order, that was ignored. And now we're in the process of negotiating a settlement that will include the removal of that at great cost, both to us in terms of legal fees and such, and to the group home operator. We think that will, in the long term, potentially could save some funds in the sense that if there's a clear signal given that, look, if you're going to have a facility in a community association neighborhood, then make sure you're abiding by their processes. In our particular case, we have a number of homes, basically because of our location, we're close to a number of community support services, such as Twelfth Environmental Health Center is close to us. There's bus routes and things like that close by that are very good for people who are served by these homes, and we welcome them as long as they maintain their properties.
Is it conceivable that covenants could say things such as no more than 3 bedrooms will be allowed in a residence, and so on and so forth?
Chairman Welsh, Representative Merkley, I don't know of such a covenant. There are in my knowledge of community association cases, there are there's kind of a reasonable person standard. I mean, you wouldn't take a 3-bedroom home and put 20 people in it, for example, things of that nature. The covenants generally govern how the structure relates to the size of the lot, how it conforms to the overall architectural feel of the community and consistency with other homes in the community, things of that nature. We don't generally get into things like, you can have 3 bedrooms or 4 bedrooms or something like that.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned, I believe, that covenants might address the number of people who could live in a house. Is that correct?
Chairman Welsh, Representative Merkley, they only in the sense that there is a general reasonableness standard in community association law that you can't take a. It would be very. It would be associations have been, I believe, supported in the courts where there have been extremely large numbers of people put in a home, but that's not an issue we've ever encountered in 35 years.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Holt.
Thank you.
I just want to give testimony. How about the city? Bill?
Oh, darn it.
Philip Sell, would you come forward, please? I have some questions for you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, indeed, what a pleasure it is to be here. We participated in the work group. And think it's a much better product than it began. Quite frankly, we still have concerns, but it is better. If we can work on it during the interim in a work group, I hope we can come up with something that works for all of us.
Bill, are you aware of what the city's having to comply with the Oxford House development and placement within communities? Federal program.
No, I'm not, Mr. Chair.
Happening in UG, we have six. Sixth one was placed, Oxford House. Oxford House, I
federal programs. Is there anybody here that knows anything about those? I'd like to please come forward here. Available for some questioning.
This is about juvenile offenders?
No, this is for the Oxford House residential treatment facilities. Are community-based and a federal program for alcohol and drug rehabilitation.
At least I know.
I know there's some people probably know a little bit about it, but it's mostly I know we're concerned on state, but some of the federal programs are out there.
Would this still apply to that?
Yes, there will be some that applies to it, absolutely, because a community, a city has an opportunity to allow siting, and they do have input. There is a process, a hearing process. We went through a trial, and they were denied in a single residential zoned area, but they went ahead and sited there anyway, and they were denied on because there was going to be 16 residences in a four- or five-bedroom house, not enough parking along the street. They sited right next to an elementary school, and parents were very concerned about it. And they thought because they were denied, they would move. In 2 or 3 years, they've been in the same site. It's a local issue, but I would be my intent. We put on notice cities that can occur. That they, if in the siting process, if it's denied, hearing offices have chosen to deny that there's some teeth in this. And I think there's victim rights and public safety concerns and groups out there are very concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
And if cities are not doing that, I think this is the issue. I think our states, I think on programs, abide certainly by those types of things much better than the federal program looks like. I think we're starting to get closer to the heart of the concerns here. And certainly I think of the type of offenders and types of programs from treatment for mental ill and those that are unadjudicated, those concerns are certainly out there. But those types going through a court process or not a court process is certainly a concern also. And types of individuals that are being placed and the possible risk to our school children and risk to our community members is a concern. But I think certainly what Pam was talking about, and certainly the ballot measure 11 requirements and restrictions have improved that for the state process. But there's some problems out there, but I think it's more federal. But if the city isn't willing to do their part,
okay.
Have you heard anything about this?
You know, Mr. Chair, I think it's mid-July and I may be getting lost. You're saying that there was an application and the city denied it, and then the Fed cited anyhow.
Yes, arrogantly. They just said, we've got the law on our side, and we have no intention of moving or changing. And they basically, it looked like they strong-armed the city.
It's a popular old song. Mr. Chair, I don't know. You say that you want the city to do its job. It sounds like it is.
I'm not sure. That's some of the issues we want to get to here.
Okay, that would be fine. Generally, I would point out that we're about 0 for 10,000 in our battles with the feds.
Yeah. Me too.
I understand.
Me too. But that's, you know, we've got to be able to identify what we can do. If we're doing everything we can do, then we've got to go take this battle up with the feds. Absolutely. Other questions? Sure. I'm not planning on moving this out at this point. I want to look at, certainly have to talk to the sponsor of the bill and discuss a little further the amendments that have been proposed in the original bill. And I'll probably have to probably just put this on schedule for tomorrow morning. Mr. Beth, I have time to respond.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir, Buckley.
When you see what the sponsor of the bill, could you remind him that the committee had asked for the list of 88 community organizations that had endorsed this bill? I haven't figured it out.
Well, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Any other questions? Anyone else want a good testimony? All right. We will adjourn for the day.